Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
From KCRW, this is DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. It's New Year's Eve, which means it's time for those New Year's resolutions. And many of you may resolve to, yes, cut back on phone use in 2020. After all, at home, at work and at school, we are spending an average of 3.5 hours on the phone daily. Teens reach around 5 hours. So on today's DNA, we're revisiting a show that we aired earlier this year. It's about kicking the phone habit through digital minimalism, or managing that habit with digital drugs.
And we rely on content increasingly as a method of self-medication. And so our premise was, and I don't mean this lightly or as a joke, what would it look like if Kenzo redesigned Pfizer?
First, though, there was a time way back in the pre-digital era when people went to bars and clubs to, well, hang out with other people, talk with other people. Some bars and private clubs in LA are trying to get back to that by asking patrons to ignore their phones entirely. DNA contributor Adriana Cargill brings us this story.
A couple of years ago, I joined a private club in downtown LA called RVCC.
So we're here at RVCC.
We are at the front desk check-in.
Chris Adams opened RVCC in 2012 as a place for the community of downtown to come together. It was strictly word of mouth and underground from the beginning, literally.
I found a vault, a bank vault.
RVCC stands for Reserve Vault City Club. It started in an old Federal Reserve building from the 1930s. You went down a bare-bones concrete stairwell, lit by fluorescent light. And then you stepped through a vaulted door that took up a whole wall.
As you would go down to this space, no cell phone reception existed, and you were told to put your phones away, that no phones were allowed. And people were scared of that. Some people were, because it was the unknown, right?
And people couldn't Google it ahead of time or read Yelp reviews. It was a real offline experience that the plugged-in world just couldn't deliver. And people dug it. So he moved the club above ground. Then they moved into another building, the Standard Hotel.
All right, let's go.
Let's go.
And then formalized it into a legal private club.
Our doors were open to the people who wanted to seek it out. And we still don't have any digital footprints of the brand.
No website, no social media, zero digital presence. Adams really wanted to grow a community strictly in person. So social media was a no-no. Longtime member Ricky Thiel learned the hard way after posting to Instagram.
And I got called out, I got sent a direct message from Mr. Adams being excuse me, could you please take that down? And
during the day, RVCC is a workspace where you can use all the tech you want. Just no documenting or sharing. But not all members appreciate this policy. Here's Isaac Simpson.
I think the RVCC policy against photos was something that was really cool 5, 6, 10 years ago and is today just played out.
But Simpson also admits he likes the atmosphere these rules create.
The nice thing about RVCC is that the reason it's saying no phones is a lot more because they genuinely want people to not be on their phones.
Founder Chris Adams' obsession with disconnecting led him and a few members to create the Analog Society, a group that gets together weekly.
Brad, why don't you go through the introduction. Welcome some of the new folks, and we'll go from there.
They give their phones to the bartender and then talk Jeffersonian dinner style. Well, sort of a riff on it, for about 90 minutes. They talk about any topic. Nothing is off limits, and it can get pretty heated. Brad Robinson is one of the founding members of Analog.
To be able to have that kind of discord with another human being, not over some sort of digital platform where there's zero accountability, you're going to have to share it with someone 2 feet away from you, face to face. And that changes the dynamic of what's going on.
I agree with Brad. The first time I went to RVCC, it was for an Analog night. And I was really impressed by the people I met, the thoughts they shared, and how much not having a phone really does change the dynamic. I'm not going to lie, though. It's a challenge to argue a point without being able to Google info to support it. RVCC has moved again, in an old bank building in the Arts District. But RVCC is not the only cell phone-free space. Chris Adams suggested I check out a secret speakeasy bar called Old Lightning in Venice. It's inside the restaurant Scopa Italian Roots. So I head there. It's dark and cozy inside, and smells like tomatoes and garlic bread. You walk up to the host podium.
Hello, hi, I'm here for Old Lightning.
Old Lightning? Yeah, okay, give me just a second.
Then, an attractive Frenchman in a suit greets you.
Hi. How are you tonight? You follow me, please?
He walks you back outside, then stops in front of a black wall next to the parking lot.
So, one rule before you walk in. I'm going to take your cell phone from you, please.
I hand over my phone.
Thank you.
Then he opens a door that I hadn't noticed was there.
Welcome in.
Instead of the usual New York Prohibition, dimly lit leather vibe, I'm greeted by color. It's got light turquoise walls and is decorated like a stylish mid-century living room. Co-owner Stephen Lavigne meets me at the bar.
Hi, how's it going?
Hi, great. Nice to see you.
As I look around, no one is on their cell phone. It feels like I've stepped back in time. The 1960s decor only reinforces the time travel feeling.
And I think just not having that distraction, not having that light in your eye, or not just wondering when bad news is going to hit your phone, you can really engage with other people. The drinks taste better. The music sounds better.
When Lavigne opened Old Lightning in 2016, he sent an email blast to 250 friends. That was it for marketing. So, in the beginning, a lot of people who came didn't know they were going to have to give up their phones at the door. I talked with patron Brad Ahrens. He's an artist manager and a father, so he's always on his phone. I asked him about the first time he got his phone taken.
At first, a little bit surprised, but then it was cathartic. It was actually easier to relinquish it than I anticipated.
Others didn't take to it as well as Aaron's.
You know, we get a lot of new parents that have kids at home and babysitters that want to text the babysitter every hour. And it's like, imagine you're in the 60s. Like, you can't call the babysitter every hour and the kid's going to be just fine.
Phones are kept in the cupboard in the bar. So if people really need to check them, they can, under the supervision of staff.
But 9 out of 10 times, the people that are, you know, the worst about handing it over, when we give it back to them at the end of the night, they say, wow, thanks so much for pulling me away from that thing. And I'm sorry that, you know, I came at you at the beginning. But that was really great to not have it. So, you know, keep doing that.
The no phone policy has, for many patrons, become the reason to go to Old Lightning. Every time I go there, inevitably, during a conversation, at some point, I reach for my phone to check the time, take a picture, and I kind of panic for a second when I realize it's not there. But I like that. It forces me to question my relationship with my phone, how dependent I am on that thing, but also how liberating it is to be without it. RVCC and Old Lightning are the only places in town that ask patrons to put their devices away. There's another speakeasy with the no-phone policy in downtown LA's Arts District. Inside Pizza Lupetti, there's a plain, unmarked wooden door. This is the entrance to In Sheep's Clothing. The draw here is not just the phone-free policy. It's also the analog music. Here's owner Brian Ling.
What In Sheep's Clothing is an experience. What we'd like it to be is an experience where the acoustics and the music are kind of way more in focus than the noise or other people's conversations.
Once you're inside, you see a bar. But instead of a bunch of booze bottles, there's an entire wall filled with hundreds of vinyl records. The floor is made of cork, and there's lots of curved surfaces and wooden beams to absorb sound. This place is a hi-fi listening bar. The music here isn't played from Spotify or some iTunes playlist. It's all vinyl, played through giant analog speakers from 1973. In other words, no digital noise.
We want people to take a break from this highly digital existence that we're all kind of like navigating through and have a respite where you can have an analog experience that's almost meditative.
Ling is a big-time music producer and manager, so he's glued to his phone 24/7. He and his consultant slash director of sound, Zach Cowie, who's a well-known DJ and music supervisor himself, travel to Japan to visit its jazz listening bars, or kissas, for inspiration.
In Japan, like, you know, they'll just go to these places by themselves. It's almost like a church or like a sanctuary or something.
At each table, there's a sign telling patrons to hear more, say less, the bar's motto. As I looked around the room, I did see people sitting by themselves or in pairs, quietly, just listening. I talk with a young woman at the bar.
It's cool, it's an experience. Well, what's interesting is that they have outlets underneath the bar. So it's like, don't use your phone, but you can charge your phone.
The tech policy here is not as draconian as Old Lightning. People work on laptops and text during the day. But in the evening, they reset the room. And if you're trying to take a Skype call or snap and pics, they're probably going to ask you to leave.
I like creating, anyone who knows me like knows that I create safe environments for people to kind of be hanging out without the fear of like being a part of someone's Instagram story.
Before opening Old Lightning, Ling created No Name on Fairfax. It's a celeb and industry-only place with a similar no phone, no photos policy. And it's no surprise that famous people want to be off the grid. But what Ling and other owners of cell phone-free spaces are tapping into is that regular people are starting to want them too. For DNA, I'm Adriana Cargill.
I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Thank you to KCRW's Independent Producer Project for that story. Coming up after this break, do you need a digital detox? Or is your phone the cure for what ails you?
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. You heard earlier about private clubs with no phone policies, but do you really need to join a private club or go to a secret bar to ignore your phone?
I think if you need to consider joining something like that, that should be the signal that there's a problem that is pretty broad in your life that you need to attack a lot more aggressively.
Meet Cal Newport. He's an associate professor of computer science at Georgetown University, and he has written a book called Digital Minimalism, Choosing a Focused Life in a Noisy World.
Well, digital minimalism asks that you essentially start from scratch with digital tech in your personal life. So you clear the slate of whatever those apps and services and devices that you sort of haphazardly brought into your life over the last 5 to 10 years, and you then rebuild from scratch.
And minimalism evokes clean, spare, white rooms with a few carefully chosen objects in them. Is that what you're suggesting people's phones become?
Well, minimalism is an ancient concept. It goes all the way back to the ancients and through Thoreau and into modern times, where it shows up in all sorts of different areas of our culture. But the basic idea is that if you focus intensely on a small number of things that give you a lot of value to the exclusion of other things that just give you a small amount of value, you end up better off.
So what kind of things do you not have on your phone?
Well, for example, I've never had a social media account. And it turns out this is allowed. You know, I still have friends. I still know what's going on in the world. I use my phone occasionally to look something up or to receive text messages from my wife. And I spend large periods of the typical day without a phone nearby. That's pretty typical for a digital minimalist.
Cal Newport wonders in his book how smartphones became just so prevalent in many of our lives. 85% of Americans now have smartphones, and a Deloitte survey from last year found that the average American checks their smartphone 52 times a day. That was not the goal when Steve Jobs introduced the first iPhone back in the ancient days of 2007.
An iPod. A phone. And an internet communicator. These are not three separate devices. This is one device. And we are calling it iPhone.
The original vision for the iPhone was that it was going to take two things that people already really like to do and make the experience much better. The vision we have today, where the phone is like a constant companion that you're looking at all the time, like an air traffic controller, looking at all this breaking news and alerting information and sending your thoughts out into the world, that was not in the original vision for the iPhone. And I emphasize that just to make it clear that what we're doing today is not something that is unavoidable.
Although I guess you could say that technology always invariably winds up being iterated over time. You know, when cars were invented, they didn't have radios or cup holders, but these kinds of things get added over time. That happens with numerous inventions. Can one really make the argument that what we should be trying to do is sort of get the iPhone back to its original intent?
I don't think we need to go back. I tell the story just to emphasize that what we're doing today is not what we did. And so my hope is that as we continue to iterate this technology, that we'll decide having these large attention economy conglomerates that are trying to monetize our attention through phones, maybe that's something we could lose when we go to the next iteration of these devices.
Now, if you become a true digital minimalist and you kick social media, what you're doing is you're saying, I don't need to converse with thousands of people on Facebook or Instagram. But people get a buzz out of that connection with the crowd. So are you saying people have to evaluate that piece of what's going on as well?
I think they should. I mean, I think if we look historically, what is weird in those two scenarios? The weird behavior is trying to do these lightweight digital pings with 1,000 weak tie connections in your social graph. The idea that you need to have all of these far-flung connections where you barely interact just digitally with people you barely know, that's largely marketing from the perspective of these social media companies. This buzz that keeps us coming back to the screen again and again was relatively crassly engineered for the express purpose of getting those engagement minutes high enough that the revenue got where they wanted it to be.
Oh, yuck. You have been likened to the Marie Kondo of technology. Do you like that comparison, and would you agree with it?
Both, right? I think Marie Kondo is applied minimalism to physical clutter. And the way she's doing it, there's real echoes to what I'm talking about in your digital life. So in Marie Kondo's world, you don't just walk through your house and occasionally find something that you don't need anymore and get rid of it, or say, hey, here's a shirt. Maybe I don't want this shirt, because you know you're never going to declutter the house that way. Instead, she says, you got to empty the whole closet. Everything has to go. And then you can start from scratch, just adding back what you really need. That's what I'm asking that you do with your digital life. You can't just take out the one proverbial pair of jeans. You know, I think you have to empty the whole closet, get rid of all the apps, get rid of all the services, then start from scratch. What do I really need in here? I think that's what you have to do. So she's on to something. And I think this idea works just as well in the digital arena.
I wonder if different generations are susceptible to different addictions. I, for example, grew up in a period where if a teenager, early 20s, you smoked. Everybody smoked. Now, people don't smoke. But now, people get addicted to their phones. Are young brains, 20-something brains, kind of more susceptible to becoming addicted to whatever kind of is the sort of the major thing that grabs them at that period in their lives?
This seems to be what we're seeing. So Generation Z, which is the first generation to have near ubiquitous access to smartphones and social media as they entered adolescence, are using these devices at alarming rate. They're using them constantly. They're constantly on the screens. They're moving the bulk of their social interactions into the digital realm. And the consequences have been really distressing. So anxiety and anxiety-related disorders among this generation skyrocketed as compared to the generation before. And you can see this hockey stick graph where the incidence of these mental health disorders takes off really quickly with age. And where that starts is exactly where smartphones become widespread in our culture, which is why I predict we'll look back 5 years later at smartphone use among young adolescents the same way we now look back at letting teenagers smoke in a previous generation. My hope is 30 years down the line, we'll look back at this constant companion model where we all just were taking in information and sending information out all day through screens and say, that was a really weird thing we tried. And I'm glad that our generation isn't doing that anymore.
You've been listening to Cal Newport, author of the book Digital Minimalism. I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Now, at this point, you may be getting ready to purge your phone of apps. But wait, there's another approach to limiting the negative impact of your devices. It's called digital nutrition. And one of the believers is Michael Phillips Moskowitz. He's the founder and CEO of ABZ Labs, and he released an app earlier this year called Moodwise. There you find tests for rating your mood, you'll find mood-lifting images and sounds and self-help koans. We started our conversation, however, by asking him how he feels about digital minimalism.
Violent agreement. I mean, look, if I had my druthers, everybody would melt their phones and join some neo-monastic order, but that's not likely achievable. It might not even be desirable. And so our premise was that, you know, if we're living in an era that might someday, in retrospect, be called or characterized as peak content, the same way that we think of tobacco consumption peaking in 1964, but it took several decades more of public health advocacy and people struggling mightily with smoking-related disease to change course or to forcibly jettison tobacco as the primary social instrument in America. And never completely. Even to this day, 16 million people are living with smoking-related illnesses. 35 million people still smoke cigarettes in America. And so I fully anticipate, you know, content is here to stay because, you know, we are creatures that are programmed to act in intensely, you know, incontrovertibly social ways. And we rely on content increasingly as a method of self-medication. And so our premise was, and I don't mean this lightly or as a joke, what would it look like if Kenzo redesigned Pfizer?
And what would it look like? Because you've tried.
That's right. So if the restriction is that you're not permitted to use pills or powder, you can't use intravenous therapies, and the only delivery mechanism is call it transorbital, or even just more generally, through your eyes or through your ears, what can we do to titillate and to tantalize, to heal rather than harm, to improve your lived experience and your mood rather than impair it? And that was our departure point.
So in principle, you're talking about sort of smoking herbal cigarettes while smoking cigarettes. It's like using the digital to alleviate the problems caused by the digital.
The insights here were that courtesy of consensus science, we know which molecules, which neurotransmitters are strongly correlated with specific feelings. So GABA can produce the sensation of calm, you know, that you enjoy or experience when you're meditating. Acetylcholine is strongly correlated with focus. Endorphins are strongly correlated with energy. Dopamine is strongly correlated with confidence, self-confidence, and reward, and serotonin with happiness. And so we now have a product suite comprising a mobile app that you can use as often as you like and hopefully to track your mood. We have an audio experience, and, you know, Kristen Scott Thomas is doing voiceovers. Devendra Banhart has produced an entirely original musical score. Daisy Lewis from Downton Abbey is doing voice. We have a whole host of people that are contributing. And the premise was, we know what podcasting is, like this. Well, what's a pill cast? How can we make a definitive impact on the way that people feel in 90 seconds or less? 90-second segments, that's pill casting.
So tell me what segment I might look at that is delivering a little shot of dopamine.
Well, dopamine is the cocaine cowboys at Facebook have been trafficking in for a long time. You can see animals being kind to animals or people being kind to animals. That can often trigger the release of oxytocin, the bonding and love molecule. If you're staring out at vistas of verdant expanses of trees and sylvan spreads in the Washington hinterland, that could trigger GABA, which is the side product, the thing that you're working to release when you engage in a purposeful act of meditation. I encourage you to download it and experience it, and then send me your visceral critique or measured praise.
which actually we did. And what we did find was indeed we did find some really intriguing visual creativity, I guess. But we also found the kind of imagery you might find on YouTube, you know, the animals being kind to animals, some cute kind of kitty images, doggy images. Indeed, yes, some sylvan landscapes. You can find those on YouTube. Why would we go to this app for these?
Why would you ever go to Sweetgreens when you can prepare a salad at home alone yourself? There's a kaleidoscopic variety of things to consume that are in physical form. Similarly, there's an even broader universe of content to consume in the digital landscape. And so we've taken a hyper-curatorial approach to pieces that we think are really, you know, palpably satisfying and potent. And then users are going to participate in the process of helping to figure out the pieces that are generally more impactful and efficient at arriving you more quickly and repeatedly at specific desirable mood states.
You know as well as I do, there's going to be people listening to this that are thinking, hang on a sec, what we're hearing is we're supposed to sit on the sofa and get ourselves a shot of endorphins, say, through your delivery system, when really what might be far better for our mental and physical health might be to get off the sofa and go for a short run.
That's right. These are some of the asks that we're making of participants in the app routinely. There are moments that we need you to stand up. There are times that you need to take the initiative of engaging in physical exercise. There are times that you need to, you know, of your own volition, reach out to friends, right? To stay connected to people, because these are things, you know, the most basic things, most simple behaviors that we often forget as our mood slides into depression. And these are things that I can identify with deeply and personally. I mean, I don't hide this fact. You know, mental health is something I've struggled with mightily my entire life as someone who suffers from type 2 bipolar disorder. I've been hospitalized for long periods of time. I've been in treatment for long periods of time. I've been on meds, off meds. And so I view this as part of a comprehensive health regimen, inclusive of, as clinicians and clergy would commonly agree, they don't agree to very much, but they do confess and confirm that there are five fundamentals to human health and happiness: diet, sleep,
community, or love,
exercise, vocation, and interpersonal relationships. Our view is that since the introduction of the iPhone in 2007, we now have a precious or paramount sixth, and that's digital nutrition.
Psychiatrists who do prescribe drugs for mental health disorders might hear this and think, excuse me, we're going to turn to some online app to do what pharmacology has proven, you know, can only be delivered through pills and powders.
Well, they are some of our most enthusiastic champions at the moment, because psychopharmacology is a crapshoot. We try lots and lots of drugs over lots of periods of time, and there are many different variables we have to consider. I know it well because I've taken lots of different drugs over many different years. Some worked for periods of time and then stopped working. Others were never particularly effective. We're not suggesting that people cease taking medication. We're not suggesting that people can use this in lieu of having to go to therapy. I think, look, there's a wide range of mood states, from being clinically suicidally depressed, which I've been, and being ecstatic and satisfied with your life, which is exceedingly rare. Most people are somewhere in the middle. Those are the people that we endeavor to help.
Are you using Moodrise yourself?
Yeah.
And is it helping?
I would say yes. I'm really moved by the audio piece. It gives me weird feelings. It's ASMR, it's binaural beats, it's readings, it's, you know, the sound of a child laughing. It's the sound of a river brook running through Kyoto as recorded live in Kyoto. It could be the sounds of Voyager rocketing through the universe past other planets. It's really unusual material. And I feel something when I listen to it. Ultimately, you know, I think this is going to become the new accepted standard, either nationwide or more broadly, so people can make more informed decisions moment to moment.
That was Michael Phillips Moskowitz. He's founder and CEO of ABZ Labs and Moodrise. I'm Frances Anderton. You've been listening to DNA. Avishai Artsy produced and edited this program with final mix by Ray Guana. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajian. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week.